Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is my good friend, Todd Harrison, the Director of Defense Budget Analysis and the Director of the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Todd is among the co-authors of CSIS's annual Space Threat Assessment. Other authors include Caitlin Johnson, Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Joe Moy, and McKenna Young. Todd, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be back, Vago.
And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems is joining us to sponsor our coverage of air and missile defense. So space has gone, right? I mean, as you've been covering for a while and we've been discussing, from a relatively sleepy backwater to a hotbed of activity, vast constellations of smaller spacecraft have been launched into orbit at a furious rate. Even, you know, you guys note in the beginning of this, right, that in just a year, we've had a dramatic expansion in the number of spacecraft. SpaceX's Starlink, for example, is a major contributor to both that capability but challenge. Great powers are stepping up their game as the U.S. Space Force gains its footing. What's different this year from last year's assessment?
Yeah, you know, there was in this year's assessment, well, the first thing we did is we focused more on just the changes, just new activities, rather than trying to catalog, you know, the full history of what other countries have been doing in terms of counter space developments. And what really stands out is over the past year, China didn't do a whole lot of new stuff. They did, you know, show a little bit more in terms of their space capabilities, you know, developing something that looks an awful lot like the X-37 space plane. But in terms of counter space weapons testing, we didn't see a lot of activity from China. Really, it was Russia. Russia was the star of the show for 2020 when it came to bad behaviors in space. And, you know, I think the thing that jumps out the most to me is what Russia did back in July of 2020, when they had one satellite maneuver near another Russian satellite and then fire what appears to be a projectile, a high-speed projectile in space. So this is, you know, clearly a demonstration done in a way that, you know, everyone could see it. They weren't trying to hide it, but they were demonstrating a space-to-space kinetic weapons capability, which is exactly what Russia, you know, out of the other side of their mouth has been talking about wanting to ban at the United Nations, right? So the hypocrisy of Russia over the past year, I think, probably stands out the most in our update.
What I think is very funny about that is it's sort of like calling Vladimir Putin a killer and Vladimir Putin being offended after having spent three decades building the brand as a killer, right?
Yes, exactly.
Why don't you just own it, for God's sakes? You earned it, for good Lord. Let's talk a little bit about, right, I mean, you mentioned the Russians and how active they've been, certainly. Let's talk a little bit about China. The Chinese did not have as active of a year. On the other hand, they're also developing their version of the U.S. Air Force's X-37B, the space plane that is extraordinarily capable, although extremely highly classified in what it does. There's been a lot of speculation about whether or not it's also a spacecraft that is merely for surveillance purposes, for testing purposes, or actually for kinetic purposes as well. Anybody who knows the answer to that is not talking. Talk to us a little bit about what our Chinese friends have been up to.
Yeah, I mean, what we can tell is they're trying to develop something similar. Now, you know, how could it be used, right? That's the big question. And, you know, they could say all of the same things about, you know, the U.S. and the X-37. And certainly the Soviets said some of the same things about the space shuttle back in the 1980s. But, you know, you start to think through, what is China developing? How do they intend to use it? Well, you know, it could simply be something kind of like a space tug that's meant to move things around in orbit. It could be an inspection vehicle of some kind. It could be intended to, you know, test different instruments or payloads and then bring them back down to Earth. Or it could be intended for more nefarious purposes. It could be used as kind of a co-orbital ASAT weapon or to intentionally interfere with other satellites to possibly grab them and deorbit them, bring them back down, or otherwise just manipulate them in space and have some sort of destructive effects. At this point, I don't think there's enough information to really say one way or the other. They are just developing this technology. And what we often see is that, you know, China does tend to copy the kind of things that we've developed. And they try to, prove that technology themselves. What's less clear is the intention here.
Let me ask before I go to solutions, right? Because you're not one to merely admire a problem and go, look, really good problems. Every year you guys have a series of thoughtful recommendations as this dynamic environment changes. But let me ask you about commercial developments, right? I mean, space is becoming very crowded very quickly. I know that there are conventions about deorbiting stuff, right? Design fairings and all of that so that they reenter the atmosphere. The Virgin Orbital guys have been talking about that. Certainly SpaceX has been talking about that as well. Talk to us about the crowded space, no pun intended, and the challenges that raises from a military standpoint.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that we touch on in the introduction of the report is that separate from what's going on in terms of the threat environment in space, the overall environment is rapidly changing. Just in the past year, you know, we've seen SpaceX launch, almost 1,000 new satellites into low Earth orbit, to the point that roughly 1/3 of all satellites operating in space today belong to SpaceX. And yeah, these are smaller satellites, but they're not that small. And they're actually highly capable. You look at the data throughput capacity of each of these Starlink communication satellites, it actually dwarfs a lot of our much more sophisticated and expensive military satellites. This is not trivial. This is a big change. And SpaceX is only at the beginning stages of building out its constellation. It's going to grow much larger in the coming years. Now, folks can debate, you know, whether or not the business case is going to close on this and whether or not they'll be able to sustain it, whether other companies, competitors to SpaceX, are going to be able to follow through on their constellation deployments as well, you know, like OneWeb and, Amazon is doing the Kuiper constellation. So, you know, we can debate whether or not that will all happen, but this much is true. The Starlink constellation is being built out in very large numbers. We are going to see the number of satellites in space start to potentially double each year in the next few years. And so it creates a lot of, you know, policy challenges in terms of what do we do about, you know, the potential for creation of space debris, interference with other space assets, you name it. There are a lot of policy issues here that are going to be forced in the next few years. And then there's the question of, hey, some of these commercial capabilities that are being built out could actually be very beneficial to the military. And so what should the military be doing to take advantage of these systems? To provide new types of services from space and to make existing military space capabilities more resilient by having, more options and diversification of capabilities in space. So a lot of issues there that are coming up.
We've even heard the chief of space operations, General John Raymond, talk about the Norwegian satellites we've bought. I remember after a visit to Norway and getting briefed on the capability the Norwegians managed to develop field, for just a couple of million dollars. I remember, having written an editorial about, hey, you know, why don't we look to do stuff like this and get innovative solutions? And I was very glad, you know, it was sort of a blind pig finding a good acorn or a blind squirrel finding a good acorn at the end of the day. And I'm glad that got adopted. you're also about solutions, right? And not just about the challenges. What are the things that need to be on the policy response sheet, right? I mean, what are some policy changes and intellectual changes and planning and budget changes we need to be considering given this changing environment?
Yeah, and so we actually published another report earlier this year called Defense Against the Dark Arts in Space. and Harry Potter theme was intentional. And, you know, what we tried to do in that report is outline all of the different options you have to improve the protection of your space systems from the types of threats that we're seeing. And I would say job number one right now for the Space Force and for the Intel space community is we've got to improve our protections against the space threats that we see Russia, China, and others developing and testing. We can't wait anymore. We can't wait for the perfect solution. There's been plenty of analysis. There are lots of options available. And so, you know, you can think of, you know, your different options to improve your protections in terms of active defenses, where you actually try to go out and attack the threat before it can threaten you, and passive defenses, where you just try to make yourself more difficult to attack. And there are a lot of ways you can do this. Some of the passive defenses are things like changing the architecture of the system. So maybe instead of launching small numbers of very expensive, exquisite satellites, maybe we could launch large constellations of small satellites that can perform the same mission in different ways. And some of these things are being pursued right now. The question really is, all right, you know, what are the mix of protections we want to focus on building out? How do we intend to use them? We need to think through, and then we do some of this in the report, thinking through, you know, operational concepts for how you would employ some of these different types of defenses. And what are your top priorities if you can't have everything, right? And I would say, you know, from our analysis, the one thing that rises to the top of the list is we need better space domain awareness. Because having a better idea of what's going on in the space domain actually enhances all of the other defenses you can build. So space domain awareness, I think, is number one. And then, you know, separate from building protections, you know, we can also pursue in parallel, you know, diplomatic approaches to try to, you know, maybe moratorium on kinetic ASAT testing in space, or, you know, building norms of behavior and building consensus around those norms, you know, so that you can start to deter or at least better identify bad behaviors in space. There are a lot of things that we could be doing in parallel, but I think, you know, the job of the Space Force has got to be focused on how do we build better defenses in space?
You know, you mentioned about better defenses, right? I mean, at the end of it, we have a tendency of sometimes not thinking about infrastructure and investing in infrastructure the way we should. Obviously, this is a priority for the Biden administration. The president has issued, his third stimulus, and it is the first of a two-part infrastructure investment that's going to total about $4 trillion, at least is what he's proposing. The first tranche is $1.2 trillion. And the administration's case is we need to think differently about infrastructure. I think Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg has it right. Like once upon a time, to critics who are saying, why isn't this only roads and bridges? He points out, you know, at some point, railroads were new too, and people didn't really think of them as infrastructure. And we need to think about this from a future perspective. I would argue that when it comes to space or nuclear or any one of these areas, we tend to short sheet investment in infrastructure. How do we need to think of space itself as infrastructure, which I know is a debate that's going on in the White House now, right? How much infrastructure investment is needed on the space side, Todd, whether for government infrastructure? I mean, how do we need to think about space as infrastructure, I guess?
Yeah, I think the first step is to recognize that it is, you know, critical infrastructure, right? And then think about, okay, well, what do we need to do to protect that? We've got a lot of space infrastructure already. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind when I think of space infrastructure is GPS. You know, there is this military system that, you know, almost everyone in the world uses on a daily basis, either directly or indirectly, right? The global economy has become intricately linked with the capabilities, you know, positioning, navigation, and timing signals provided by GPS. That is critical infrastructure. So what can we do to protect it, to make it more resilient, to augment it, improve it, right? And, you know, the military is already doing a lot of that for both civilian and military purposes. But then, you know, start to think even more, okay, well, there's lots of communication infrastructure that runs through space, you know, commercial communication satellites. And then the part that, all, you know, a lot of times we forget is for all of these space systems, they have a ground segment that they're also critically dependent on. That ground segment is part of the critical infrastructure for our space systems. And so, you know, we got to think about maybe we need some additional rules and regulations for satellite, you know, ground control facilities in terms of their physical protection, in terms of their cyber protection, and their protection from, you know, electronic warfare activity, jamming and spoofing, right? So there are a lot of things that we could do. But then also the government, you know, at this time of trying to stimulate the economy and help build infrastructure to stimulate long-term economic growth, the government might have an important role to play here in helping provide, you know, or basically be a base customer for some of these new space companies that are trying to build out new elements of space infrastructure, you know, communication systems, but also some of the commercial remote sensing systems, you know, that do imagery, they do hyperspectral imagery, that do synthetic aperture radar. Could the government be an anchor customer to these systems to allow them to get up and running and close their business case and start to become, you know, a new part of our nation's infrastructure?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the ground station part of it, right? I mean, it's fascinating that in the Britain's Defense Command paper, I think people have a tendency of forgetting the ground-based infrastructure that goes with space, right? I mean, fiber optic cables still carry a lot of the world's data, even though space information is traveling through those undersea cable networks, fiber optic cable bundles. And I think it's interesting that Britain in its Defense Command paper noted the importance of having ships in order to monitor the safety and security of those cables, unfortunately, because a lot of that capability now has migrated to Chinese ships, and then a concern about what sort of other maybe unauthorized equipment might exist on undersea cables and vulnerabilities. You know, we know that Russians have said, well, you know, an anchor fell and severed that cable, alas. You know, it was a really important cable. Was it an anchor falling, or did somebody actually cut it? Let me push you on. Go back to the beginning of a conversation a little bit, right, Todd? The first thing that went into space was a weapon was the V-2. It was a battleground during the Cold War. If you asked Tom Stafford or Frank Borman or any of the Apollo astronauts, they would have said that it was important to get to the moon. They were doing this in the a great power competition at the height of the Cold War, right? It was a national and military activity. When we see Russia doing what it's doing, we have all sorts of space treaties. There's a concern about militarization of space, which I think is a little too late. But from a weaponization standpoint, what are some of the things that the United States and its allies and partners have to do? What are things we can do with the Russians and the Chinese? What are things we have to do on our own? How do we change the dynamic here? Because we are steadily marching with tests like the ones the Russians did, with tests like the ones the Chinese did, tests like the ones we have conducted. India conducted a kinetic ASAT test as well, anti-satellite weapon test. How does the United States, the new administration, have to think about this space?
Well, so first of all, we've got to recognize, you know, a lot of this depends on how you define terms. So, you know, what is getting into space? Is it above a certain altitude, like 100 kilometers, or is it actually getting something into orbit? And the militarization of space, that typically refers to the use of space for military purposes. Well, you know what? Space has been militarized pretty much from the beginning. As soon as we could put things in space, you know, we started using that for military advantage. Now, the weaponization of space, you can define that a lot of different ways. But I think most people would consider putting a satellite in space that is capable of kinetically attacking another satellite in space. Well, that qualifies as a space weapon. If that qualifies as a space weapon, then space has been weaponized since the 1960s because the Soviets were doing it, were building and testing these types of systems back to at least 1963. I think we've got to stop and recognize that space is militarized and we like it that way. Space is already weaponized, whether we like it or not. Our choice, our decision is, how are we going to respond to that, right? Are we going to wrap ourselves around the axle trying to define things better? Or are we just going to say, you know what, it is what it is. We are going to protect our systems, our space systems against these forms of attack, whether they're based in space or on Earth, whether they're kinetic or non-kinetic. And we're going to work through, our allies and partners to try to build consensus around the norms of behavior in space that discourage this type of activity or at least, make international pariahs out of the countries that do try to disrupt the space environment and, potentially damage other people's satellites. So, I think there's a lot of things we could do, but it's going to require concerted attention from the most senior levels of government. And I'll say that, so far the Biden administration, at least initially, did not show a lot of interest in space policy issues, whether they're, security or civil space or commercial space related. It is starting to look like maybe they are getting read in a bit more and are starting to pay a little more attention to space with the news now that they're going to keep the National Space Council intact. I think that's a wise decision. But really, it is going to require, senior level focus within the administration to move forward on some of these initiatives that are quite frankly long overdue.
And from let's talk budget a little bit. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of discussion in Washington about the holdup on skinny budget and when it's all going to, right? I mean, now it's June, although I think everybody understands there is a new administration, trillions of dollars in pandemic spending, right? I mean, so there will be a trimming of the sails, although there is a consensus that we're going to be, flat budget, flat inflation, right? I mean, the debate and the discussion is centered around roughly the same place, 704, 708 for the Pentagon's part of the budget, and then about 738 for national security at the end of the day. But on the space side of things, Todd, right? I mean, what is the investment that we need on the space side of the equation? We now have a Space Force. Obviously, there are a whole bunch of organizational stuff that has to happen. The last administration did increase space exploration spending. The good news is the president is a giant space fan. He wears an Omega Speedmaster watch. He has a piece of, he's got a chunk of moon rock in his office. So this is somebody who clearly regards space as something not just historically important. What is the kind of spending that we need on the military and on the civil space side?
Yeah. So, in terms of building out the Space Force and the organization, that stuff is really more of just making smart policy decisions. It's not a matter so much of funding. And in fact, if they started adding lots of new positions, I would be worried they're going in the wrong direction in terms of how to build it out as an organization. You don't want bloat. You want to keep it lean and a flat organizational structure. And I think that's what they're headed towards. There are a lot of space acquisition programs that are in the pipeline now, and their funding needs are going to grow over the next 5 years or so. That growth was already baked into the five-year plan in last year's budget. I expect to see that continue. Where I do have some concerns and where I think additional funding is going to be needed is, number one, to follow through on the new space architectures the Space Development Agency was beginning work on. Proliferated low Earth orbit set of constellations for missile sensing and tracking and for data transport. I think they've got to follow through on that. That's going to be key to building more resilient space architectures in the future and more defendable architectures. But also, I think they need to, you know, be investing in a wide range of other defensive capabilities, including some active defense capabilities that at least, you know, in the unclassified budget, we don't see that being developed. But, you know, things like a physical seizure capability, having a satellite that can grab an uncooperative object in space and move it to a safe location. That's an important capability to have in a lot of scenarios, you know, where there can be ambiguity of, is this a threat? Is it not? Is this an actively controlled satellite, or is it a dead satellite or piece of debris, right? If you had the capability to actually reach out and touch them and grab them in a way that doesn't produce debris, right. You know, that's a difficult technical thing to do, but it is doable. You know, those are the kind of capabilities I would want to see them invest money in and do it openly, because those are the kind of capabilities we want other countries to know that we have, because that helps deter some of their bad behavior.
And I'm sorry to burst out laughing like that, but when you said uncooperative satellite, right? It's like, you know, it's had a couple of beers. It's being uncooperative. It's very, very important. You know, the U.S. Space Police are up there to make sure.
You know, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Get out of my orbit.
Exactly. Get out of my orbit. The General Raymond needs a badge in that case, right? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, what's national security space? You know, do we need a national space guard, right? Sort of like a Coast Guard. Like, anyway, I don't want to get any ideas going. You're the one who got the Space Force thing running anyway. Todd, always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so very much for joining us. Looking forward to having you back on again.
Glad I could do it.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.